This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio from the American Tobacco Historic District. And 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to say that because there was no public radio station here, no Burt's Bees, no Glaxo, ad agencies, architecture firms, or software companies. Just an empty shell where a thriving tobacco product plant used to be. And the transition from manufacturing to intellectual and information-based jobs was by no means certain. For years after the plant closed in 1987, this place was a ruin, kind of monument to despair. So much so that it was the location for the film adaptation of Margaret Atwood's post-apocalyptic novel The Handmaid's Tale. Durham has changed a lot in the last several years, and a few weeks ago there was a survey of top creative class cities in America. Durham came out on top. And what happened to Durham has happened in other cities, too. So last month's rankings raised the question, several of them, in fact, what is the creative class, what's the significance of it, and how did Durham come out on top of other cities like New York, Los Angeles, or Seattle? Richard Florida is senior editor for The Atlantic, a professor at the University of Toronto and NYU, and author of the book The Rise of the Creative Class. He's the one who coined the term creative class. And a revised 10th anniversary edition of his book is out this year. He joins the show today. Richard Florida, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Hey, Frank. Thanks for having me on. Quite a fantastic story that you led with. I was very interested to hear about that.
It is an amazing story, and we'll talk more about that. And there's someone here who has been here through all of it. Gary Keebler is with me now in the studio. He's the CEO of Scientific Properties in Durham, a development company here in Durham. He also created the website Open Durham. And Gary, it's good to have you back as well.
Thanks so much, Frank.
So, Richard Florida, when we say creative class, what are we talking about?
Well, back in 2002, I came up with this fairly simple and straightforward metric. You know, economists had typically looked at the vibrancy or economic capacity of the city by measuring the percent of residents who have a college degree. And that's a great measure. It's a fantastic measure, and it's very robust. But what I wanted to take into account were two things. How do we count the kind of work people do, especially people who may not have a college degree? And of course, we quickly noticed that people like Bill Gates or the late Steve Jobs or many entrepreneurs do not happen to have a college degree. And second, our analysis, which we report in this new revised edition, shows that while 9 in 10 college grads do this kind of creative class work, 4 in 10 people who do it don't have a college degree. So what we define the creative class as is a couple of key groups. The first group is scientists, engineers, innovators, and techies. The second group is the arts community, so artists, visual artists, musicians, but also graphic designers, industrial designers, architects, entertainment folks, and folks in the media. And then finally, the third group is really what others have called the classic knowledge worker, you know, someone who uses their mind at work, whether that be in management or marketing or in the healthcare fields or legal fields or in education. Put all of those together, it's about 40 million Americans, and on average across the United States, it's about a third of the workforce who, though, take home and account for about half of all wages and salaries in the United States today.
So a third of the workforce, half of the salary, and something you said early on that's very interesting, 4 in 10 of that class don't have degrees.
Yeah, this is the work of a fantastic young economist at the University of Maine, a big update on the original work that I did, where he was able to look and compare education levels to people in the creative class. And only 6 in 10 creative class workers have a college degree. And in Gabe's work, Todd Gabe's work, which is fascinating, you know, obviously having a college degree gives you a higher salary. It also mitigates your propensity to be unemployed. College grads never had an unemployment rate in the crisis of over 5%, while working people were in 10, 15, and 20%. The creative class, having a creative class job is the equivalent of having 1.5 years of additional college education. And get this, for people doing this kind of work in Durham and around the country, their rate of unemployment also, members of the creative class, never hit 5%. So not only, and the average salary for these jobs is over 70 grand. In some regions, like the Silicon Valley, it's over 100 grand. So the creative class really is a robust feature of our economy. And you know, while sadly and tragically so many people have been negatively affected by the downturn, not to say that people in the creative class haven't been hard hit, but compared to working class, blue-collar people, or people who toil in the service industry, the creative class has performed much better, including the 4 in 10 members of the creative class who didn't go to college.
Yeah, and I want to stress that point that you just made, that during the worst of the downturn after 2008, less than 5% of what you would call the creative class lost their jobs when we were looking at 12% unemployment nationwide.
So we see a very stark geographic pattern. Of course, the one that Durham, and we'll talk more about this, of course, benefits from. But one of the things we found and other research groups have found is, you know, our country is going through this complicated geographic sorting process as talented, ambitious people cluster in some areas, and the other areas have less and less, whether it's creative class or college educated. And in fact, we always do a case study. It's funny that we're talking about this, Frank and Gary. We always do a case study in my course on economic development based on North Carolina. And it becomes very clear that while Durham and the whole Triangle area has a very large concentration of creative class people, other areas of North Carolina, as well as other parts of the country, have much less. So in a sense, we're talking about not only two classes, but two geographies that are shaping our country.
Well, Gary Kieber, what does that mean for the city of Durham? And I should say that we're going to try to find out more about the specifics of this survey. But one thing we know is that when the survey talked about Durham, it included people in Person, Orange, Chatham, and Chatham counties. And so it was a wide area. People who lived there, many of them worked in Durham. So it's kind of a wide area. But in terms of the creative class, 48%, this survey found, 48% of the workforce was part of this creative class. What does that mean to a city like Durham and a development company? You look at the impact, the economic impact that might have.
Well, the fundamental economics of this area have been good and have insulated us to a great degree from a lot of the effects of the recession. Fortunately, you know, the presence of Duke and UNC in particular, when you talk about folks that are in education and healthcare industries, which form a good chunk of the creative class metric, you know, Duke and UNC are really the bedrocks of that. And with Orange and Durham County in this, I mean, Duke is, I think, the second largest employer in the state with 34,000 employees. So, and that's the genesis of RTP in the 1950s. I mean, this state started a transition away, in particular in the Triangle in the 1950s, seeing that the handwriting was on the wall with manufacturing, tobacco and textiles dying, having, I think, the second lowest wage in the country in the 1950s. So transitioning to an engineering, innovation, whatever, knowledge-based worker economy started 50, 60 years ago here. So we're really, and that was based on the presence of 3 universities and the talent and the draw that was there. So we've been leveraging that for a long time in terms of creating more innovation, more knowledge, more entrepreneurship. So we're seeing the fruits of that at this point.
Does that explain why a city like Durham succeeds? Because remember, the city's reputation was not always the best, and we just said after 1987, the collapse of the tobacco industry, not a lot of hope in this city. Durham succeeds where cities like Detroit, Buffalo, and others fail. They can't seem to bring themselves back to their original glory.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, and this is one thing, Richard, you've captured extremely well in your book, is, you know, the fundamental shift in the preferences of folks, particularly young folks, who are seeking out amenity-rich environments and are looking for authenticity. And so, you know, while we've had a strong technological entrepreneurship, healthcare education industry for a long time, the core of Durham as a post-industrial city remained more bun for a very long time. But what we've seen and what we've seen from the real estate development side and more broadly is that as preferences have changed, you know, folks that are particularly under 35 are looking for these old renovated tobacco mills, these old textile mills, places that are walkable, have bike trails, et cetera.
Richard, Florida, is this just good for the creative class, that one third in the case of Durham, close to half of the workforce, or does it help the rest of the workforce and the rest of the city as well?
In a way, it does help the rest of the workforce, although it's quite complicated. I'm doing research with this with my group at the University of Toronto as we speak. Generally speaking, service workers and blue-collar workers in communities, metro areas, and that's what we count when we count Durham, that have a high percentage of the creative class or a high percentage of college grads, the wages for service and working class members rise a great deal. So in a sense, everybody's basic wage goes up. But the problem is, And this is, and I don't know because I haven't looked specifically at Durham, but when you take a New York City or Greater Boston or San Francisco, even though the creative class wages rise sufficiently that they can cover housing costs, that is not true for blue-collar working people and service people. So there is a benefit war for wages, but taking into account housing costs, the creative class does appreciably better. What I say in my book, of course, is that the key to making our society a more unified society and driving economic growth is that we have to creatify all jobs. And this is particularly hopeful and optimistic. When we look at the skills that you use in work, there are three basic skill types that we can define using very interesting Bureau of Labor Statistics skills data. The first are physical skills. The returns to physical skills in America are going down. The second two skills define creative work, cognitive work, intellectual work, knowledge work, cognitive skills. The second skill is kind of a social intelligence. Can you work well in teams, manage people, and lead? Those skills not only drive the wages of creative class workers up, but if you go to a factory or an occupation in the blue-collar world or in the low-skill service work, if they add skill and knowledge to that job, the wages rise even faster. So I think the key to our economic growth in the future is to make more work creative work. Fortunately, in Durham, you're already near the 50% mark. And remember, even during the Great Industrial Revolution, we didn't even touch 50% of our workforce in blue-collar manufacturing work.
So, we'll talk more about how to creatify the workforce and whether Durham is on the road when our conversation with Richard Florida continues today. He is the author of The Rise of the Creative Class. Also with us, Gary Kieber, who is CEO of Scientific Properties. And you're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We're going to come back. You'll be back with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, and today we're talking about Durham's creative class. What is the creative class? How did Durham end up with the largest one, percentage-wise, in the country? Richard Florida's with us. He is senior editor at The Atlantic, a professor at the University of Toronto and NYU, and author of the book The Rise of the Creative Class. He's the one who coined the term creative class. Revised 10th edition of this book, 10th anniversary edition, I should say, is out this year. And joining us now is Kevin Stolarik. He is on the program and a research director of the Martin Prosperity Institute. He completed this study about the creative class around the country, where Durham ranked number one. And Kevin, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Frank.
Tell us what this means now and a little bit about who these people are in Durham and how you found this to be true. What's going on? Break down the numbers for us a little bit.
Well, so, I mean, what we really look at, I always like to use the acronym TAPE, T-A-P-E, to talk about creative workers. Because when you say creative class, everybody automatically kind of thinks, oh, it's artists and musicians and designers. And it's not, right? As Richard has, you know, talked about, right? People being paid to think. And so the idea of the TAPE is that it's technology workers, right? So it's tech workers and engineers and programmers and people that are doing that kind of work. It is artists, right? The A is artists and musicians, designers, right? People doing the more kind of typically culturally creative kind of work. The P are the professional classes, business, medical, legal, right? Financial professionals, and then the E are educators. And what we see is that if you look at that, right, I mean, you know, it's the fastest growing group. As Richard just said, right, they make a lot of money. But when we did the update for the new book, we went back in and got numbers for 2009, 2010. And Durham comes out with almost 50%, 48.4% of the workforce in Durham are actually members of that creative class.
So when you do that, that's Durham, but it includes a wider area, right? These are residents who live and perhaps work in places that are not Durham.
Yeah, it's Durham. It's the Durham Chapel Hill metro area. So it's Chatham, Durham, Orange, and Person. And what happened was part of what
you're on a cell phone. You're breaking it. Yeah, breaking up a little bit.
Sorry. The landline wasn't working, and now the cell phone. When we did the update, when we did the book 10 years ago, Durham and Raleigh were combined. And since the government, right, the Office of Management and Budget actually defines the metro areas, they said, no, we want to split them up. Each, you know, kind of independent, they look at commuting patterns and all kinds of other things. They still combine them for some things, but we actually were able to split Raleigh from Durham and Chapel Hill. And so you see, Raleigh still does fairly well. Right? Raleigh-Cary has 37.5% of its workforce is still creative workforce, so it still does fairly well. But it allows Durham to kind of rise to the top with that, those revisions.
But there are some interesting features about that. If, for instance, Durham County, if you just look at Durham County, it doesn't rank in the top 20 than the city of Durham and other counties. Orange County it kind of ranks ahead of it. And I don't want to get into a horse race here, but Gary, what does that tell you about the impact of the creative class and its the reach of that impact, I guess?
Well, Frank, I think the major point is so that we have a very we're well suited for the new economy. I think the overarching message that that Richard makes in his book is that there's been an ongoing shift, and this shift is becoming ever more pronounced as time goes on towards an economy that focuses on creative output, entrepreneurship, traditional thought workers. And, we have an incredible base with the universities, the healthcare system, the amount of money the healthcare system and those universities bring in. So that it's reasonable to look at the Orange County and Durham County and the amount of people that live in one and work in the other, and that the employment crosses county lines in these cases, that we're well suited for the future as they look at it.
Richard, as we lost our industrial base, the economy fractured into the intellectual, the information-based society and a service society broadly. You talked about creatifying the other sector, this service sector. Does a creative class in your midst have an impact on the service sector, or are they do they operate separately?
Well, yes. I think I say in the book, it's our obligation now as the advanced force of post-industrial capitalism to help improve those jobs and to add creativity. And I wanted to go back to just a couple things Gary said, because they're really critical. I think one of the things we found in Kevin, who is the statistical genius behind this work, who looks at the data, and when we looked at the new data and these new metropolitan units, we found that college towns, which performed well in 2000, really have risen in an unbelievable way over the course of the last decade. On our overall index, our creativity index, which puts in up, Boulder was first. Detroit, you mentioned, might be having trouble, but Ann Arbor was fourth on our overall creativity index. And it in every state, whether it's Gainesville or Lexington, and as Kevin mentioned, your area, Raleigh, Cary is 24th, while Durham is first. So I think having spectacular universities, having made those investments, as Gary said, in three great universities, Duke, University of North Carolina, and North Carolina State, where that little spinoff company, SAS, came from, is critical. But the other thing Gary said that's really important, and we could see the glimmers of this a decade ago, but it's what Kevin and I are working on at the Institute now, it's really this shift away from just the suburban Nerdistan, which they used to call the Nerdistan model of an office park. Now, they are still very robust, and Apple and Google and Facebook are in office parks. But for young techies in Durham, in the tobacco factory, in Manhattan, which is now the second largest cluster in the United States, even in downtown San Francisco, where Twitter has it, creating this ability to renovate old structures, to be authentic. And what I think is the key, when you talked about these multiple counties, I think what makes the Durham area, Raleigh and Cary, robust is it has something for everybody. It has the authentic old structures with walkability for young people or empty nesters. If you have a family or you want to live out in the suburbs, you have that. And I think that's what happened. That with the colleges and universities and that portfolio of lifestyle options is what drove Durham to the top.
Well, Gary, you're the CEO of Scientific Properties that developed Golden Belt in East Durham. Tell us about that and how that fits into that picture.
Well, I think a great example of this, and it's not unusual. It's very similar to American Tobacco and a couple of other repurposed manufacturing facilities that we have. We've been fortunate to be able to utilize federal and state historic tax credits that have helped Durham redevelop these buildings. We started off with the intent of, we were a little bit outside of the area that was burgeoning. And we started off by building something that had a creative center to it, really, as its identity. So the core of this 160,000 square foot former textile mill, 35 artist studios, gallery space, And then from there, apartments, retail, office, et cetera. Simply because it's been conventional wisdom for a long time that artists are more willing to live in areas that have, you know, other people are prejudices for whatever reasons aren't willing to go into. And so, you know, we moved with that in a very deliberate way to say that, you know, art is a great equalizing force among folks and will draw people to an area.
Because that's been, of course, the big criticism of any kind of redevelopment or gentrification is that it forces out the very thing that made it attractive in the first place. You made a deliberate effort to keep artists there and also not force out the local neighbors by developing some kind of neighborhood organization and leadership that allowed them to get services that had been neglected for a while.
Yeah, we were really intent on not being the displacing force. And we had a lot of abandonment, 5% home ownership in the adjacent neighborhood when we moved in. So we undertook an effort along with Habitat. We've each taken abandoned houses. Each of us have done 9 at this point, renovated abandoned houses, and placed owner occupants in them. While not making any efforts to obviously displace anyone else.
But how's it working out for you?
It's working out well. We're 93% leased, and artist studios stay very full. You know, we're part of the art scene in Durham. You know, Third Friday is a big hit where people come out and enjoy it. So, you know, it has been – we have been benefited by being in Durham and in the broader Triangle economy such that, you know, we've continued to experience growth.
Kevin Stolarik, Richard talked about universities being one of the characteristics, or university towns being sort of in the vanguard of the rise of the creative class. Are there other demographic or any other features or characteristics that stand out as you look at the statistics?
Well, I mean, what we see is, and it saw with a colleague of mine, Gary Gates, 10 years ago, when we started looking at this, was that really places that are open in the also places that are really successful.
And I'm going to ask you to repeat that because you just dropped out.
Okay, it's places that are open and inclusive, right, are also places that are really successful. And so what you find is, I mean, what Richard and Gary first looked at, right, they started with a list of kind of, you know, the Nerdistans and the tech centers and the list of the most gay-friendly places in the U.S., and they found a lot of them were the same.
So it's inversely, so the number of Chick-fil-A's is inversely corresponds to the creative class. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not going to go to Chick-fil-A.
You should do this Chick-fil-A thing. I've just done it. I've just given you safe cover. The more Chick-fil-A's, the less creative class. I heard it. Richard Florida said it on this show.
There we go, yeah.
I'm sorry. It was Frank Stasio said that. Go ahead.
But it's open. But it really is. And the other thing, right, it's not just gays and lesbians, right? Because the other thing, too, I always say, I end up, you know, meeting with mayors and counselors and stuff who say, oh, I want, you know, they want to shorthand this. You know, all we need to do is get some gays and a bike path or two in here, and it's going to solve all of our economic problems. It's like, no, it's not, right? But it's a sign, and it's also about foreign-born, and it's also about, you know, seeing artists and others, right, the people who generally are seen as outsiders. Because it's not only about openness to people, that's also about openness to new ideas and new ways of doing things, which really is where success comes from.
Frank, I'll go to Chick-fil-A. As someone who spent his life encouraging diversity and tolerance, I'm with Mayor Michael Bloomberg on this. You don't ban fast food joints because of the position of some bozo. Now, I might not go to Chick-fil-A and buy myself a sandwich, but I think it what's happening now in some of the more, and I'm using small p, progressive communities, it looks like the same kind of intolerance that other communities. So I say leave them alone. On Kevin's point, you know, and Gary's point, I asked Jane Jacobs this question about gentrification, and she was such a master of great one-liners. But the one-liner she said to me, I think is her greatest ever. She said, but Richard, when a place gets boring, everyone, even the rich people, leave. And so what Gary has done, one, at the economic level is fantastic. Two, from a point of view of equity and social justice, is terrific. But three, it's protecting long-run value. And that's why I think you can in a way, have it all. You can have a robust economy. It can be a better place, a more just place, and it can be sustainable. And that's what I think is the real hope of the creative age. But it won't do that on its own. Without people like Gary and public policy that encourages this, it gets quite skewed.
So I think that's where our nation has to head. We have to make sure the creative age benefits more of us.
Are there intangible cultural features to add to this, Gary? I'm thinking you moved here in 1997 to do your residency as a medical doctor. It was right about that time they did a referendum on the ballpark across the street here. And that's certainly been key to the development of this city. You know, tell us about that story, how it came about. I mean, is there something about it, you know, is this little city that can? I mean, is it some intangible that we're not capturing here?
Well, I think the irony of that, Frank, is, you know, Richard mentions, I had to laugh in reading the new edition of the book, the Richard calls out the sports stadiums, and we we did exactly that back in the mid-90s, which is the, you know, Durham's downtown, in particular, while our regional economy was doing well, Durham's downtown was not doing well. And one of the things that was proposed was the Durham Bulls, our minor league baseball franchise, might be moved to a more regional location. Voter referendum was voted down to build a new stadium. The city went ahead and spent, I believe, $18 million on building a new stadium designed by the same folks who designed Camden Yards in Baltimore, which, of course, is adjacent to this very large former tobacco complex we're sitting in right now, a million square feet. Was the same owner, then ended up redeveloping this complex. So it was, I don't think that triggered the resurgence of Durham's downtown, but it was a key moment of investment. It happened at the right time. It happened just as people were shifting their preferences towards living downtown and playing downtown. So it turned out to be a good investment that we've done that.
Well, it brought a lot of people downtown who had otherwise, maybe coming from other parts of this region, who had ideas about Durham that were dispelled pretty quickly when they came and went and had a good time.
I think one of the interesting things is that we've had this economy that has been knowledge-based, that has been technologically-based, entrepreneurial-based as a region for a long time. Durham has been, you know, in a large part of that, particularly during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, kind of the loser in that. In the 90s and now, Durham has really left to the top as preferences have changed. So, but that's key in that it's kind of marinated in this overall regional economy that has some great fundamentals and had, as I mentioned earlier, made this shift to a knowledge entrepreneurial-based economy, you know, decades before with RTP and attracting companies that at that time the preferences were to be in a large suburban office park complex.
Mm. Richard, I want to get you to talk a little bit more about something you said earlier, the fact that as these cities flourish, other places are really beginning to diminish. Is this a kind of zero-sum game? Is it a kind of competition? Or is there enough room? It seems to me if you're talking about creativity, we can simply go on infinitely. But it didn't sound like that's what you were saying before.
If you read Paul Romer and the other really smart people who are talking about where growth really comes from, they're saying growth comes from knowledge and creativity, and that's an infinite resource. It's an infinite resource. What we have in our country, unfortunately now, is a split society, and that's the objective reality. There are some places that are thriving and some places that are falling farther behind. And Gary said something very, very important that I want listeners to pay attention to. He said it was a 50 to 60-year transformation from the bottom. That's two generations. I saw Boston on the same timeline as Durham. Now it's back. But in Pittsburgh, it's only been 30 years, and they're now getting over the hump. In Detroit can and it likely will come back, but they're only a decade or so into it. So this is a long process of remaking an economy. But my own hope is that what we have to do, and I call it in the book, we need a new creative compact for every American. Every single human being is creative. That means every region, whether it's in their factories, in their service business, in their oil refineries, or on their farms, has the seeds of a creative economy. And instead of trying to prop back up the old housing, auto, energy complex, we should be doubling down now on doing what you've done in Durham. And I would challenge Durham. Let's get the other 50%. And if the decade brought Durham to the top of the pack, let's see what Durham can now do for the other 50-plus percent of blue-collar folks and service folks. Can Durham actively, through public policy and engagement of its business and civic and university leaders, begin to upgrade those jobs? And I would say that would be the key to success over the next decade. And sooner or later, it isn't happening too much, sooner or later, some region's going to see that, and it's going to expand its creative economy to encompass a much more larger and robust sector of its workforce.
And are these local and regional projects, is there a role for the federal government and federal policy in encouraging this, or do we do that in spite of it?
I think the federal government is hopeless. I mean, Kevin knows this. This is the only time we've not worked closely together in the past decade. I tried to move to Washington, D.C. I took a position at George Mason. And I tried to work with the federal government, and it's completely dysfunctional. Not saying that something good may or may not happen. It's the mayors, the local officials, the leaders like Gary, the civic entrepreneurs and social innovators that are all over this country that are making change. And you know, Ben Barber, my good friend, the political theorist, has a book coming out. I wish, this is one of the few book titles I wish I had, If Mayors Rule the World. And I think he's nailed it.
Richard, thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Kevin and Gary, I want to thank you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Appreciate it.
Richard Florida, senior editor at The Atlantic, professor at the University of Toronto at NYU, and author of the book, The Rise of the Creative Class. Kevin Stolarik is research director of Martin Prosperity Institute. Kevin Kieber is the CEO of Scientific Properties. He's the guy who created the website Open Durham. Coming up next, more on the creative clash and class. I suppose there could be a clash of the creative class, but that's not what we're going to talk about. National Museum of Art has purchased an original work of art by Ai Weiwei, and we will learn more about it just ahead. Stay tuned.